our podcast, Intrigue Explained, which looks at geopolitical issues, is off for a couple of weeks. But as one of the three co-hosts, I wanted to record something because the US House of Representatives has just passed a significant Ukrainian aid bill that has been in train for many months and blocked in the House. There's an expectation that it will now quickly pass the Senate and be signed by the president. And there have been a lot of arguments made against it. So I wanted to record something talking through some of the most common arguments used to attack this move by the US and share some of my thoughts on how I would go about engaging with those arguments. To do that, I'm going to adopt a couple of ground rules just so you know what you're going to get. First of all, I'm going to treat every argument as if it were made in good faith, even though obviously they aren't always made in good faith. I'm going to do my best to accept the premise of the question and accept that whoever is making the argument genuinely believes the things that they are claiming to believe. Secondly, I am going to do my best to focus on the arguments and not the personal history, politics, or my assessment of IQ of the person making them. And those two rules are really because my fundamental belief is that if often you can unpick an argument just by attacking the person making it, and often it is egregious and offensive that certain arguments are being made by certain people who really have no standing to be able to put them forward. But in order to really convince people and in order to comprehensively debunk a bad idea, you need to be able to unpick it regardless of the source. Otherwise, you're really risking that argument coming back with a more polished or more candid messenger. I'm also, in that vein, going to be ignoring hypocrisy or double standards as a counterargument. There are many positions on which you can say, well, hold on, previously you said this, or what about this other thing that sort of seems similar, but you went in a different direction. I'm not going to use those arguments because, first of all, I think it's not necessarily hugely convincing. It is possible for someone to be hypocritical and yet right on the merits at the same time. And secondly, especially in international relations where countries all have very checkered pasts, any argument can be attacked as being hypocritical or of a double standard, and you really paralyze all debate if that's what you reach for each and every time. I'm not saying others shouldn't explore those arguments or point out hypocrisies or double standards when they see them, but for the purposes of this, I am going to try not to use those arguments and attack the position entirely on its own merits. So with that out of the way, that throat clearing, the seven broad arguments I'm going to be attacking this time, and thank you to those on Twitter who helped me crowdsource some extra ones, are first that the aid either prolongs the conflict or encourages more bloodshed. Secondly, that it won't make a difference, that it is an escalation that could end in nuclear war. Fourth, that it could be stolen by corrupt Ukrainians or other corrupt actors. Fifth, that it detracts from the real threat, which is China and Taiwan, and the US should be focusing its resources there. Sixth, that it discourages Europe from stepping up. And seventh, that it could be better used towards other priorities, either domestically, the border, or some other domestic priority of the United States. So I'm going to deal with those one by one. Those aren't the full totality of arguments that are being thrown around, but they're the ones that I've seen, they're the ones I've chosen to focus on. So let's begin with the idea that this aid either prolongs the conflict or encourages more bloodshed and violence. This is sometimes the extreme version of this positions the war as a proxy fight between the US and Russia, in which the Ukrainians are just pawns of the US. That's a really extreme version of the argument. A milder form of the argument basically just says you're just pouring more fuel onto this fire when you should be trying to de-escalate it towards a negotiated settlement. There's a couple of problems with that argument. First of all, the bloodshed is happening regardless. One country, Russia, has invaded and is continuing to invade another country, Ukraine. It is attempting to seize all Ukrainian territory, really, by force at this point. It attempted to take the capital, and Ukrainians are resisting. They were resisting on day one before the majority of Western aid had even begun to arrive. And in fact, following years of Western powers slow rolling even arms sales to Ukraine for fear of antagonizing Russia into doing exactly what it ended up doing anyway. Ukrainians are fighting because they largely want to fight. That's not 100% of the country feels that way, but enough of the country that they have maintained a courageous and spirited defense. No amount of aid could force a Ukraine that doesn't want to fight. They're fighting because they want to fight, but they need aid in order to do it effectively. Ukrainians on the ground are saying that they need all sorts of things, but most notably artillery shells and missiles to be able to blunt Russian offenses, as well as air defense to stop the relentless, frankly, terroristic attacks on Ukrainian cities and infrastructure. What's holding a deal back, so this notion that we would have negotiations if it weren't for this aid, isn't the fact that Western aid keeps coming. It is the fact that there are some intractable problems that prevent a negotiated settlement here. There is a fundamental disagreement between the parties about who huge chunks of Ukrainian territory should belong to. Ukraine, especially following the atrocities in places like Bucha, is understandably horrified by the notion of leaving Ukrainian territory in Russian hands. And Russia is as yet unwilling to accept that it does not get to own some or all of Ukraine. There's also a more fundamental problem, which is that any kind of negotiated settlement, in order for it to be trustworthy, would need security guarantees from the West. Putin very clearly cannot be trusted to keep to an agreement merely because he has entered into an agreement. I don't think that is hugely controversial in international relations to say. At any rate, the Ukrainians certainly wouldn't trust any agreement where the only enforcement mechanism is that Putin gave his word and doesn't want to go back on it. They don't believe that is a trustworthy enforcement system. The only trustworthy enforcement system anyone can imagine is if the West offered concrete security guarantees, that if there were a peace or some sort of ceasefire and Russia violated that ceasefire, the West would enter the conflict on the side of Ukraine, and thus that threat would keep Putin in line. The West is unwilling to offer those security guarantees, which is one of the main reasons the Istanbul kind of negotiations fell apart a couple of years ago. So it really, that fundamental impasse is blocking any form of outcome, at least at the moment. There is also the issue that if you follow the logic of this argument through to its conclusion, or you strip everything else away, what it's basically saying is, at the moment, Western aid is giving Ukraine hope that it will be able to, either through attrition or through offensives, push Russia out of some or all of its territory. And if we take that hope away by cutting off aid, we will then push Ukraine to the negotiating table. The problem with that argument is if you flip it, and you look at it from Russia's perspective, Russia says, hold on, if you take that hope away from Ukraine, we're just going to achieve our objectives militarily. Why would we negotiate? Putin was asked about this in an interview that then went out on RIA Novosti and I think it was Russia One TV. It was on the 13th of March of this year. And he said, listen, it would be ridiculous for me to start negotiating with Ukraine just because they're out of ammo. This is the precise time I shouldn't negotiate because they are running out of material to fight this war with me. So I can achieve my objectives militarily. I don't need to negotiate. If your thought is if we take away Ukraine's hope, that'll push Ukraine to the negotiating table, even if that were true, and it's far from clear that Ukraine wouldn't simply move to asymmetric warfare, make do, and continue fighting, you would then just take away any incentive Putin has to meet you halfway. Because if Western aid's not coming, he's going to achieve what he needs to do militarily. And finally, just on the notion of bloodshed, a lot of this money is going to go to things like air defense that are going to shoot down missiles and Shahed drones heading for apartment blocks in civilian cities. That saves lives. It doesn't take them. So I think there's a strong argument for a lot of that aid, even in a, not in the sense of it's going to kill a lot of Russians, but in the sense it's going to save Ukrainian lives. So that's how I would talk about that argument. The second argument I want to look at is the idea that it won't make a difference. Effectively, this argument says that the math of this war is locked in. This aid package is either too small or no aid package could be large enough to allow a country the size of Ukraine to withstand and or roll back a Russian offensive. Russia is simply too large and too powerful. And so this is effectively throwing good money after bad. This is a waste of money that won't change things on the ground. Now, it's really hard to tell, obviously, I'm not a military expert. I have no idea how much difference this particular aid package will make. I know that Ukrainians have been begging for aid for months, that the cutoff of US aid has seen Russia being able to go on the offensive for the first time in quite some time, that reports from the front talk about units that are holding on but are having to hoard every artillery shell and that are being massively outshelled by a Russian military that isn't shell-starved at the same time that Ukrainians are. We have President Zelensky talking about the fact that some of the recent hits on, for example, the Ukrainian power plant occurred because Ukraine simply ran out of anti-air missiles to shoot down the incoming cruise missiles. So there are concrete ways in which the money will make a practical difference. Now, will it be enough to surge Ukraine eastward and push Russia all the way out of its territory? I don't know. I guess I'd probably be skeptical. It's a really hard war to make big advances in. But fundamentally, this is a war of attrition. It is the key question is, how long can Russia sustain offensives and a presence on foreign soil, economically, industrially, politically, versus how long can Ukraine, backed by the West, do so? In a war of attrition, every shell counts, every missile counts, and billions of US dollars buy a hell of a lot of shells and missiles. Russia seems to be able to some extent, regenerate its manpower reserves, and it has vast reserves of old Soviet equipment it can draw on. But the war has obviously taken a toll on its strategic forces, as well as on its more modern equipment, whether that's planes, modern tanks, and so forth. At some point, the hope is that cost may become too high, or they simply lose enough of the more advanced stuff to make advances impractical. That's the long-term strategy here. It is entirely reasonable to say, hey, $40 billion alone won't make a difference. I'm not a military expert, I can't comment on that, but for me, perhaps that's maybe an argument for more countries to do more rather than to do nothing. The third point, and I'm only going to touch on this briefly, is the idea that this aid could be escalation toward nuclear war. You actually don't hear this one as much as you used to, I guess, because often the people making it have been rattling that particular saber for quite some time and no nuclear war has transpired. The few things I'll say is that, listen, Russia's nuclear doctrine is really clear. It envisages use of nuclear weapons when Russia's existence as a sovereign state is threatened, or when Russia's own nuclear forces are threatened. None of that is going to occur in Luhansk, Donetsk, Crimea, or Kherson. It's simply, or Zaporozhye. Russia is not facing an existential threat here. The Russian nuclear triad is as intact as it's going to be. There's no threat to that. Putin himself keeps reaffirming this and keeps saying, no, we're not going to use nukes. So it's not really clear how a couple of extra Patriot batteries are going to cause Putin to suddenly push the button. He seems to want to live as much as any of us do. In fact, judging by how he acted during COVID, a lot more so. So I don't think a bit of a military reversal somewhere outside of Donetsk City is going to suddenly cause him to bathe the world in nuclear fire. That calculation has served me in pretty good stead for the last couple of years, and I don't think anything's changed this week. I have believed and still believe that the West probably got the escalation mix right. They have avoided, to the best of their ability, a situation where NATO troops and Russian troops are in direct military conflict. They didn't put up a no-fly zone, though many called on them to do. They've generally avoided that kind of situation for fear of escalation while providing military aid in increasing quantities. I think that's probably the safest right mix, and it's hard to imagine any form of military aid short of actual US or NATO troops on the ground that would push the escalation bar too high. There are also charges that the aid will be stolen by corrupt Ukrainians. There's an even more kind of extreme version of this, that it's all some sort of money laundering scheme for Hunter Biden. I don't want to get into that last one because it's patently ridiculous. It's hard to launder a Patriot missile system. It's not really how money laundering works anyway. But I think we should also be realistic and say that, yes, there is corruption in Ukraine. Unfortunately, there's still corruption in Ukraine during wartime. But this is not the first country that the US has dealt with that has some corrupt elements in it. There should be, and there are, systems in place to prevent US aid being stolen, expropriated, or sold on the black market. Ukraine is working hard to catch and punish corrupt officials for obvious reasons, because every corrupt official is effectively taking shells out of the pockets of frontline soldiers, and that's horrific. And so there's systems in place to do that. Could they be improved? Sure. Is that a reason to abandon a young democracy to being overrun by Russia? It doesn't feel like it, especially because a lot of the aid is going to be structured in the form of payments to US companies. So it's not like this is going to go through the hands of a Ukrainian oligarch or a corrupt Ukrainian official that can pocket a lot of this. It's effectively a fee for service to US companies. I should add that there are some people who believe that is also a problem, that effectively this is a big giveaway to US corporations. Certainly there are US defense contractors that will benefit from this. US defense spending generally is very generous, so I don't think that Raytheon is struggling day to day, but certainly there will be some benefit from it. But listen, it's fundamentally, it's a fee for goods and services. There are things that Ukraine needs and that the US House of Representatives has decided it wants to give it to them, and the people who make it happen to be defense contractors. Certainly, again, there should be systems in place to make sure that the US taxpayer doesn't get gouged, that it doesn't overpay for things, that the Ukrainians get things they can practically use, that to the extent that there are some financial contributions to Ukraine, that those are monitored. But these are problems the US does know how to solve and has been working with all regimes all over the world, which have, frankly, far worse corruption records than Ukraine under Zelensky. They know how to deal with this, and while some corruption is inevitable, it doesn't seem like a reason to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's a geostrategic argument that's made that basically Ukraine and aid to Ukraine is pulling the US focus and US assets and US resources away from its primary geostrategic antagonist in the People's Republic of China, and away from potentially defending Taiwan from a Chinese attempt to reunify by force. There's a couple of arguments I would make to challenge this. Now, first, obviously, the US passed a Taiwan aid bill at the same time as the Ukraine aid bill. And if the US felt that should be larger, they should have appropriated more funds. But obviously, there is an extent to which they're able to walk and chew gum at the same time. But I think more concretely than that, probably Taiwan's greatest defense, apart from the fact that it houses TSMC, and if there's a war anywhere on Taiwan, global chip manufacturing grinds to a complete halt. And I don't know what our economies all look like, but its greatest defense is basically the US strategic ambiguity. The fact that while the US hasn't or generally shies away from ever explicitly saying so, it heavily implies that in the event of an attempt by China to militarily change the status quo on the island, the US would intervene militarily to protect Taiwan. That perception is probably Taiwan's greatest military asset. And having the US very rapidly lose interest and abandon, for whatever reason, a military conflict in which a young democracy was invaded by a one-party, effectively a one-party state in Russia-Ukraine, sends the exact opposite signal. It basically sends the signal that when push comes to shove, U.S. support for Taiwan may be nowhere near as robust as the U.S. would like to project that it would be, that there will be actors in the U.S. system capable of paralyzing U.S. response and U.S. appropriations, and that basically the U.S. will ultimately decide that it's not worth it. An appropriation of whatever, $60 billion over a couple of years seems like a high price tag, but not sending it could have a higher price tag still in undermining this notion that the U.S. is ready to step up and live up to its sort of commitment and its status as a defender of global democracy. I would also add, and this kind of goes to the previous point about some of these funds going to the Raytheons of this world, the U.S. arms procurement around this is effectively a reinvestment in the U.S. defense industrial base that report after report after analysis has said has basically withered as during the war on terror, the U.S. pivoted away from a defense industrial base that was designed to fight any kind of peer power and towards fighting strictly asymmetric warfare. So this sense that by pumping in money into the kind of things Ukraine needs, which are in a lot of ways the baseline materials of war. So we are talking about large numbers of munitions, shells, infantry fighting vehicles, tanks, artillery systems. You are setting up the U.S. defense industrial base to be more formidable should it need to rapidly scale up in the event of a conflict with someone who is more in the U.S. weight class than Afghanistan and Iraq were. So an enemy like China. There's a global argument that aid to Ukraine discourages Europe from stepping up, basically that Europe can free ride on you. It'll give Europe the sense that they can free ride on U.S. aid. They don't need to invest in their own defense, that they don't need to contribute to their regional security because the U.S. is there. I'm not ready to say this argument has absolutely no merit, but I do think it is hugely overstated. Europe has actually been contributing to Ukrainian defense considerably. It doesn't get talked about a lot, but if you add up the contributions from the European Union collectively, they now exceed those of the US, at least before this bill. Countries like Denmark have contributed huge amounts of material in percentage terms. Europe is having active conversations about strategic autonomy and rebooting its defense industry. Now, does that come from a low and some would say complacent base? Yes, absolutely. Is this kind of U.S. reluctance to engage in Ukraine or U.S. paralysis over this bill contributing or a push factor for that? Yes, very possibly. But on the other hand, a complete U.S. inability to support Europe and the signal that U.S. wouldn't be there at all could well push a lot of European countries in the opposite direction towards appeasement, where they're saying, listen, without the backing of the world's sole superpower, are we really sure we want to adopt an adversarial attitude with Russia at all? Wouldn't it be easier to just sacrifice Ukraine and potentially start contemplating sacrificing some of the Baltics if it means a peaceful life when we don't have the US behind us? So I think it's a complicated question of how do you get that? I'm also just not sure that 50 million Ukrainians and Ukrainian soldiers should have to pay the price and go without vitally needed artillery shells in order to send Europe a message that they should reduce defense spending from 1.7 to 2.1% of GDP. It's a good message to send. This just doesn't necessarily feel like a a fair way to send it if you are doing so via Ukraine. But at any rate, the lesson seems to be very well heeded. Even countries like Germany are now talking about significantly raising what they are going to spend on defense. Finally, there is an argument that from a domestic perspective, there are arguments that, look, this is money that could be better spent at home. Sometimes you can hear all sorts of priorities listed. The border wall is a really common one. Like, why are we sending money to Ukraine when we should be securing the southern border? Why are we sending money to Ukraine when we have a homeless population in the US? Why are we sending it to Ukraine when we have high costs of housing? You could make an argument for all sorts of domestic priorities. Now, obviously, there is no spending that can't be attacked as saying, why are we doing this when we could be doing something else? I think a pretty valid question to ask immediately is, oh, okay, cool. So what is the specific bill or budget priority that you would like to see funded that now won't be funded because of Ukraine? And I'm not sure that there is a border bill moving through the US Congress, for example, that would have passed were $60 billion not appropriated for Ukrainian defense. It's not really how US spending and budgets work. The challenges at the US border, for example, are immensely complex. They have It's about processing, it's about enforcement, it's about where to keep these people, it's how to judge who is a legitimate refugee fleeing violence versus who is not entitled to claim protection under refugee status. It's about beefing up the courts to make sure that they can process claims quickly. It's about keeping track of people as they cross borders. It's an immensely complicated, and how to reform US immigration has been a debate for pretty much as long as I can remember. But the idea is, oh, we would have fixed the border were it not for Ukraine aid, doesn't necessarily seem like the two are tied together. The US is not $60 billion away from fixing its border or fixing homelessness or fixing anything else. And even if it were, it could find the money. It's not that this money is only for Ukraine and for nothing else. If there were a bill that could find bipartisan support, that could sail through, that the president would be happy to sign, that the Senate would pass with a filibuster-proof majority, that the House of Representatives, which is controlled by a different party to the US president, would all happily agree on, that would get done, and I am sure that the US would be able to find 60 or however many billion dollars for it. The issues on anything from immigration to healthcare to homelessness are that there is not any politically salient solution that the US political system agrees would help and would then fund. So those are seven of the arguments that I have heard and that people suggested to me on this issue. I hope you found some of these helpful. I hope they're a little bit helpful to you in talking to your friends, family, co-workers, and pets about this issue. As always, feel free to get back to me and to get back to us if there are things I've said that you wildly disagree with, if there are issues you feel I should have covered, if there are questions you feel are left unanswered, or especially if there are knockout arguments on these issues that I forgot to use. Thanks so much.